So, you're a millionaire. Now what? More Americans than ever are facing that question. As of 2006, there were nearly 9 million millionaires in the U.S., a very large number of them in the high-tech hotspots on the West Coast. Microsoft alone had created, according to the New York Times, approximately 10,000 millionaires by the year 2000. Well, our next guest, John Wood, was one of them. You might remember he told his story in the 2006 bestseller, Leaving Microsoft to Change the World, An Entrepreneur's Odyssey to Educate the World's Children, how he joined Microsoft in 1991, quickly rose to become the company's man in China, but quit almost 10 years later to found the charity Room to Read to educate children around the world. So what happened after his splash on the bestseller list and Oprah's couch? Let's find out. John Woods joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
You said you wanted to be the Andrew Carnegie of global libraries. You know, he built, what, over 2,000 in the U.S. So tell us, how are you doing? How's it going?
Well, my thanks to the local Room to Read teams around the world, we are making great progress in being the Carnegie of the developing world, bringing libraries to kids who have never had access to books. We think we'll have over 10,000 libraries open, serving 5 million kids by the end of the year 2010.
But is there an epilogue? I mean, this is a pretty heady, successful story, but is there an epilogue, too, of what I did wrong, what I learned, how, when it got hard?
Oh, you'll always learn things, I think, because what we're doing has never been done before. And I always tell my teams, you know, if this was easy, it would have been done by now. I mean, everybody wants kids in the developing world to have access to books. But when you're talking about setting up libraries in post-apartheid South Africa or post-Khmer Rouge Cambodia, certainly it's not easy. But I think that's all the more reason we have to focus and be long-term investors.
Well, for instance, you've said you don't take money from the American government because you don't want to get caught up in any ideological problems of any administration, you know, whether or not you could have books about condoms or, you know, any of those restrictions that a government might put on you. Have any foreign governments restricted the kinds of children's books you can put in libraries or the kinds of reading you can put in libraries?
They haven't, because the way that Room to Read works is we outsource the decision to the local level. The decision of what books get into one of the Room to Read libraries is made by our local employees in consultation with the local Ministry of Education. We use local authors and local artists to print books in languages that have never had children's books before. So as much as I'm the spokesperson for Room to Read, it is Nepalese making decisions in Nepal and Zambians making decisions in Zambia.
For those who didn't read your book or see you on Oprah or the rerun, you were with Microsoft, as we said, and on a 3-week trek to Nepal. And you came across a school with a library, but without books?
Yeah, the empty library. No desks, no chairs, no shelves, no books. And the headmaster was very hopeful. He'd hung a sign out in front of the library that clearly said, library. But when you it was an aspirational sign. When you walked in, there were no books. They had 450 students in this school who are all very, very eager to read. And this is, of course, one of millions of villages throughout the poorest parts of the world where this is the catch-22. They're too poor to afford education, but until they have education, how are they ever not going to be poor? So that headmaster spoke a sentence that would, for me, forever change my adult life. And chapter one of my book is called Perhaps, Sir, You Will Someday Come Back with Books.
They had a few books, but they had to keep them locked up, you know, again, another irony, because they didn't want kids to mess them up.
Yeah, and all the books that they had were, you know, 20 books for 450 kids that were all backpacker cast-offs. So I'm no literary snob. I think every child should read Danielle Steele romance novels at some point of their pedagogical development.
But not in the library.
Not an 8-year-old Nepali kid.
Well, but so you send an email to your dad about collecting books. You go back to Microsoft to work. Suddenly there's thousands of books. I'm really synopsizing your story, but you and your dad go on this real bonding trip back to Nepal to deliver the books and are greeted with what?
Oh, it was extraordinary to go back to Nepal a year later and deliver those books and make good on that promise to come back with books and to see hundreds of children lined up greeting us with flowers and putting their hands together and saying namaste and bowing to us. And I felt like we had done so little. We had just collected 3,000 used children's books. And one of the teachers grabbed my hand and he looked me in the eye and he had tears in his eyes. And he said, "You have done so much for us and we can do so little in return for you." And I found it hard to explain to him that what he had done is he'd given me the feeling that maybe I had some meaning in my life, that maybe my life wasn't going to be about making rich people richer. It was going to be about helping these kids to get that same gift that all of us have had, that gift of having a library from a young age. Having something that basic be missing just makes me question all this prosperity we have. Because if a billion people can't read or write, I feel like it's our job to get out there and help them have access to books.
Well, and you left this very heady world of Microsoft disenchanted with it, we should say. And I read in an article that some people encouraged you not to put all of your disenchantment in your book. But now you find yourself in the charitable world, and you're taking a closer look at that world as well. I mean, you've said that much of the charitable world gets a free pass. What do you mean by that?
I think a lot of people give the charitable world a pat on the back, that if you're trying, that's good, congratulations. But there's not enough people challenging the charitable world to be more effective, to take their solutions to scale. And when you do see the charities, let's say Teach for America, that have begun to go to scale, it's so exciting to see.
What do you mean go to scale?
Go to scale to mean to actually come up with a solution that is in line with the size of the problem. I'll give you an example of this. People say that Room to Read is amazing because we've opened 5,000 libraries in just 8 years. And I say, that's great. We're proud of that. But that's just a complete drop in the bucket, a drop in the ocean.
How many people are illiterate?
There's 800 million illiterate people in the world today, 2/3 of whom are girls and women. And so when I talk about scale, I say, let's not pat ourselves on the back for doing 5,000 libraries. Let's ask ourselves, how can we open 1 million libraries? And until we do that, let's not pop any champagne corks.
You say we need to be the Starbucks of charities.
Well, Starbucks, yes, in terms of actually looking at the market opportunity and saying, can we open outlets quickly? And we have actually benchmarked ourselves at Room to Read vis-a-vis Starbucks. In their 8th year after their initial public offering of stock, they opened 1,000 outlets, which was a lot. In Room to Read's 8th year, we opened 1,600 libraries. And I use that example because I think that if we can take that private sector mindset, and you can't go all private sector or else you lose your soul, but if you can take some of the best of the charitable world and combine it with the best of the business world, then you end up having solutions like what we've come up with at Room to Read. Last year, we opened 4 new libraries a day. That was 1 new library every 6 hours. So it meant that every day, over 1,000 kids in the poorest parts of the world got access to their first library. And that's going to, I think, change the world for a lot of those kids.
Well, what do you think about the questions that are being asked in general about the philanthropic / foreign aid world? Nicholas Kristof writes about a 2007 study by two economists, Rajan and Subramanian. It finds that the picture is muddy at best for what can be accomplished. That let's say if the goal is to save lives short term with vaccinations, that's where aid works best. But if the goal is to make economies grow and countries grow, something almost what you're talking about, that aid and charity doesn't really work.
Well, I think foreign aid's a bit like cholesterol. You know, there's good cholesterol, there's bad cholesterol. There are some fantastic solutions out there. You know, when the Gates Foundation announces that it's going to try to wipe malaria off the face of the earth, wow. That's bold. That's something we should all stand up and applaud for. And that should be a challenge for the billionaires of the world everywhere to follow the example Bill and Melinda are setting, to follow the example Warren Buffett is setting.
That's John Wood. He left Bill Gates' Microsoft to start his own charity, Room to Read. By 2006, he's established 2,500 libraries and 210 schools around the world. We'll have more with him after a break. And later today, the nation's former top auditor is suggesting that we all give up some retirement benefits to reduce the national debt. That's later. Back with more from John Wood in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from John Wood. Microsoft made him a millionaire. He quit, though, and founded a charity called Room to Read. Just before the break, we were asking about how effective charitable work is. And, John, you talked about there being good and bad philanthropy. You think the work that Bill and Melinda Gates or Warren Buffett is doing is good. But you're critical of the bad. Now, why? The papers are, you know, splattered with parties and events, people raising money for charities, and a lot of that money from the new tech boom you were part of. So what's wrong with that?
I think we need to stop talking about how much money people are spending and talk instead about what is actually getting done. Filling the bank account is only one part of the equation. And I think what we need to do is stop giving people a free pass to say, oh, billionaire X committed $100 million to this problem. Let's talk about whether or not they've come up with an effective solution.
And you say you also want to democratize philanthropy, maybe make it less about billionaire X?
Yeah, I think if we wait for the billionaires of the world to solve our problems, it can be like waiting for Godot. And people all the time say, oh, well, Gates is going to solve that. Well, you know, I think everybody can be part of the solution. Everybody should be part of the solution. And quite often the stories of an 11-year-old saving their allowance is equally compelling as whether or not a billionaire gives $100 million to the public library.
Well, and going back to how you run your organization, you just monitor for 3 years.
to make sure that some of these places haven't converted the library buildings with the bathroom facilities and all of this into chicken coops.
Right.
And then you let it go. For you, it's a bottom line thing. It's the cost of maintaining and running them. The other part, I'm sure, is about teaching them how to fish rather than give them the fish. Are they fishing? How many kids are reading?
A key part of our challenge at Room to Read is basically getting the parents involved in everything, whether it's building a school or constructing a library. One of the problems, I think, going back to your question about foreign aid, is when you give everything to a village, they're not going to value it. You know, the old adage that nobody ever washed a rental car before returning it to the Hertz counter. If you don't feel ownership, then there's no sense taking care of something. So at Room to Read, we devise what we call the challenge grant. Every project has to have parental input, sweat equity, labor, land donations, small amounts of money, so that the parents will value it. And there's nothing quite like seeing a group of parents the day a school opens in Nepal or a library opens in Cambodia. And the parents are so proud because they've put their labor into that project. So we've not given them everything. We've maybe done 50%, 70%, 80% of the resources, but the parents in the community have done the rest. It's almost like an old-fashioned barn raising. But it's happening today in Cambodia, Nepal, and South Africa, where parents are putting their labor in because they want their kids to get a good education.
And do these library buildings and schools remain library buildings and schools? Have any been
taken
over?
They do. Room to Read invests heavily in monitoring and evaluation along with training of the librarians so that we can make sure that things are being well run. We go back on a quarterly basis, as an example, to the libraries to see, is the library open a set number of hours per week? Is there a checkout system in place? Is the librarian trained? How many kids are visiting the library? Very simple measures that can be done literally on a clipboard with a pencil with somebody visiting the library to see if the conditions are right for that library to be used. And I don't think, you know, every single one of these projects is going to be successful over time. When you open 2,000 libraries in a year, I would be happy if, you know, 90% plus were successful. There's no, I think, ever a guarantee of an outcome. What we are trying to do is guarantee kids the equality of opportunity.
As we said, the whole project was sparked by your own trip to Nepal and the library that had no books. But are you doing anything in the U.S.? I mean, there are problems with books and libraries in the U.S. and with reading levels in the U.S.?
Oh, there certainly are problems everywhere in the world. And I think that the difference between what we're doing and what's being done in the U.S. is that we're working in places that are absolutely resource-starved. We're working in places where, I'll give you an example of Cambodia, where 2 years ago their education budget was $96 million for the entire country. And, you know, that's less than what a, you know, medium-sized university in America spends per year. The way I look at it is if you view it as a child, as a child, as a child, and I'm looking at how do you find the places with the greatest resource deprivation where literally you can put a girl in school for $250 a year, where you can build an entire school library for $4,000, and that reaches 400 kids. So it's literally $10 per child to reach someone in Cambodia or South Africa with their first library. And in that sense, I think that we can do a little on finite resources. And I have to be honest with myself. Room to Read has finite resources. Every dollar we spend, we have to go out and fundraise. We don't have an endowment. And so in that sense, we have to spend money very, very carefully. But parents are the same everywhere. They want their children to have a better life than they've had. And that really comes down to education. Yet we live in a world today where this morning, over 200 million children in the developing world woke up and they did not put on a school uniform, they did not grab their book bag, they did not walk to school, and they did not learn. 200 million children, and this is in a time of the greatest era of wealth creation in human history. So what I'm trying to do is connect those two things, great wealth with great need.
And how important is the girls aspect of this? Because I know you have scholarship for girls, and you mentioned that two-thirds of the illiterate of the world are girls.
Yeah, I think that the lack of educational opportunities for girls in the developing world is one of the great overlooked issues of our time. Because if we can get girls' education right, it sets a baseline that every future generation can get educated. Yet if you look at, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, there are countries where only 1 in 5 girls even starts sixth grade. So why do those societies have problems? Well, if 80% of your girls who eventually become women and mothers don't even finish sixth grade, then I think that that society starts with, you know, fights the war against poverty with one hand tied behind their back or both hands tied behind their back. So Room to Read's Girls Scholarship Program is aiming to underwrite scholarships for girls and give them that guarantee that we'll stick with them through the end of secondary school and let them get a complete education. And there's a direct link between so much of what's good in the world and girls' education.
The Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen speaks of this as well, that educating girls also leads to more manageable birth rates.
Family income, family health, knowledge being passed down to the next generation. yet there are literally tens of millions of girls who do not go to school. And I just think that's, we can do better than that. Every little girl everywhere in the world should go to school. That's just, for me, non-negotiable.
John Wood, founder of the charity Room to Read, his 2006 book about his experience is called Leaving Microsoft to Change the World, An Entrepreneur's Odyssey to Educate the World's Children. John, thanks for catching up with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.